The final investigator I met with was Dr. Bruce Chesson, who began our chat by presenting an older woman from his practice.
This is 73-year-old delightful woman who was diagnosed with CLL in 09, incidentally found to have a lymphocytosis of 5,900. She underwent evaluation, it was found to be CLL, and all these prognostic factors were then done. She was unmutated IGVH, she was CD38 positive, and she had a 13q deletion, but also 17p. So she should have been a really bad actor. But we were able to follow her without therapy for a number of years, but her absolute lymphocyte count was growing and eventually hit over 180,000. That didn't bother her in and of itself, but eventually she developed symptomatic anemia with splenomegaly on physical exam. So we had been waiting and waiting, and finally ibrutinib was approved for 17P in the frontline setting. So we started her on that medication not too long ago. And she experienced a steady decrease in her lymphocyte count over the next 3 months, so that it was, when I saw her last week, down to 22,000. Her hemoglobin was normal, her spleen no longer palpable. She had no adverse effects from the drug except for initially some easy bruising, which disappeared. She said she's felt the best she's ever felt in several years.
So let me pick up on a few of the points of this case. The first is the fact that you were actually able to observe this lady for a number of years, in spite of, in particular, the 17P deletion. So I don't know what people do in practice. I kind of had the feeling they maybe don't watch the patient as easily if they're 17P. Your approach to watch and wait is the same regardless of cytogenetics?
It's the same regardless of any of the prognostic factors, and that's the reason I put forth this case, because it shows that some patients, I have another gentleman with 17P I've been following for 5 years, no treatment ever. It's not the risk factors, it's how the patient behaves. It's not the white blood cell count. It's the eventual symptoms and laboratory findings which follow it that will compel us to treat. And those patients can go for a long time. We sometimes see a rapid increase in the lymphocyte count that will then plateau for months or years. And so a single number doesn't compel us to treat. It's the patient that tells us when treatment is indicated.
So another question about this patient. Did she have sort of this lymphocytosis that's seen in a lot of patients who get ibrutinib?
Actually, she didn't, which surprised me. And when I reread over her notes, I was thinking I was going to be able to talk about that. That's an interesting phenomenon. It's a demargination phenomenon. And the lymphocyte count can go up several fold, up to the hundreds of thousands. And even some of my colleagues at work start getting scared. Oh, the patient's now got a lymphocyte count of 200,000-300,000. I say, okay, that's nice. There's no correlation between whether it goes up or doesn't and the patient's eventual response. It's just something that you shouldn't let scare you in and of itself. In fact, we published a paper a couple of years ago after a workshop that I held to make it clear that there are a number of drugs that are associated with what looks like progressive disease, the flare reaction with lenalidomide, this lymphocytosis, and now we're starting to see it with the checkpoint inhibitors in solid tumors as well as lymphomas. It looks like the patient is progressing in some areas, but everything else seems like it's getting better. So in this case, you've really got to give the patient the benefit of the doubt and the drug the benefit of the doubt, follow them carefully, repeat the appropriate test, and come to a good clinical decision as whether the patient is really progressing or not. Lymphocytosis alone now is not considered progressive disease in CLL in patients on these drugs.
So another aspect of this case is that you mentioned she had easy bruising. Mm-hmm. Can you talk more specifically about when this occurred and how it was manifested? And in general, what you've seen in terms of dermatologic issues or bruising with ibrutinib?
Ibrutinib has a couple of unusual adverse effects. One of them is bruising and bleeding, bruising much more than bleeding. This occurred in the first couple of weeks on treatment and then didn't happen again. And most of the patients I've had who have had these sorts of complications with ibrutinib, it's been cutaneous. I've seen a couple of nosebleeds. I've had a patient who had a conjunctival hemorrhage, but I had a patient a week or so ago who died from an intracranial hemorrhage.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was very, he was a guy I've been taking care of for about 20 years.
Intracranial hemorrhage from nothing pathologic, just being on ibrutinib?
Correct.
Wow.
It's not the first. There have been others. I had another one, but he survived. This patient didn't. Because they're pills and because they're generally well tolerated, you can't assume that everything is going to be easy. And you have to be careful. And this helps us select one drug versus another in some patients. I have a chap now with mantle cell lymphoma who wants ibrutinib for his relapsed disease, but he's in atrial fibrillation and he's on anticoagulation and he's got a platelet count that's low. So, you know, I said, no, I'm not going to do this. You've got to know the potential adverse complications. They are uncommon, but with a man like I had, you know, 2 weeks ago who died, you know, when they do happen, they can be bad. But those are really, really rare, but it is possible.
What's known about the pathophysiology of what's going on?
With the bleeding, it's not clear. There was a paper in Blood a few years ago about having some impact on von Willebrand's factor, but it hasn't been clearly elucidated besides that.
And in terms of the patient, such as your patient with atrial fibrillation, I've heard people say that they're, you know, maybe would change the type of anticoagulation. Is this a relative or absolute contraindication? How do you think it through?
Well, if I didn't have alternatives, it'd be more difficult. But we have idelalisib, which is also a very effective drug. And we'll talk about that in a subsequent case. I'm just uncomfortable right now with someone on anticoagulants giving them a drug that predisposes them to bleeding. I don't know really what to do with the atrial fibrillation. I've got another CLL guy with cutaneous CLL who's had a very nice response to ibrutinib but developed atrial fibrillation. And it came and went, and he didn't have it last time I saw him. And since he'd just gotten his month's supply, we're going to see what happens over the next month. If he starts fibrillating again, we'll probably switch him to idelalisib.
What about the type of anticoagulation? Do you think one is safer than another?
I'm not sure. It's a little conflicting in the opinions on that, whether Coumadin, heparin, or Lovenox is different from Xarelto, one of those. I'm really not sure. Until we're really certain, have a lot of data, I would just be cautious across the board. It may come out. The signals are worse with some of these, like with heparin. But I'd like to see more data before I was more liberal with the use in anticoagulated patients.
How do you approach the issue of the patient who needs surgery? Do you stop it before? When do you begin it after? And what about things like dental procedures?
Yeah, very good question. We generally stop the drug about 5 days before and start it about 2 days after for surgeries. For colonoscopy, where we think there's going to be a biopsy, I had a patient the other day who said, oh, I've had polyps before and they're probably going to find them again. That one I said stop it, but a routine test I probably wouldn't. Dental work, it depends. If it's going to be just routine stuff, that's one thing. But if it's going to be, you know, yanking out some teeth or whatever, then I might be more concerned and hold it for a few days.
Moving back to the issue of upfront treatment of CLL, in the patients who don't have adverse factors, specifically 17P, how do you think through that decision? And if you could, would you use ibrutinib in those patients, in all patients?
Yeah, we published in 88 and then again in, I guess it was 96 and over again, the recommendations for starting treatment in CLL, which are disease-related symptoms, fevers, drenching night sweats, unexplained weight loss, and you can throw profound fatigue in there, bulky nodes or rapidly growing nodes or big spleen that's growing, recurrent infections, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, those sorts of things are indications to treat, but they're not always easy because fatigue is difficult to measure. I have a lot of patients who come in and say, you know, just can't play my 18 holes of golf anymore. And I said, okay, you think it's time to start treatment? They go, no, let's wait a little while longer. And then eventually they'll come to the point where I'm taking naps every day and they say, okay, let's get to it. So I watch and wait a lot of patients with CLL. And I think that's appropriate. I have patients I've been following for more than a decade who have never been treated. And I use the indications plus a dialogue with the patient as to when to start therapy. Should we get tempted to use a drug like ibrutinib up front in watch and wait patients? I think not. It does have toxicity. It clearly has expense. And as I said, they can go years and years without needing anything. By that time, we may have second, third generation BTK and PI3K inhibitors that won't have these side effects. We're still learning how to use them, but I think upfront in everybody is probably not the right decision. For example, if you give someone BR or FCR, you may get a remission that lasts 5, 6, 7 years unmaintained. If you give them ibrutinib, you'll get a partial remission. We don't know how long it's going to last, but at considerably more expense and issues of compliance and copays, et cetera.
So another agent we're hearing a lot about in CLL and other places is ABT-199 or venetoclax. Do you have experience with this agent and particularly related to tumor lysis syndrome?
Well, ABT-199, we have a couple of studies going on at our institution. One in 17 P-deleted patients, which was opened before ibrutinib got that indication, and one, as I mentioned, in ibrutinib IDELA failures. I think the drug overall is well tolerated. In the initial phase one trial, there were two patients who died from the treatment. The question about how carefully they were overseen has come up. But in the more recent studies with the new schedules of administration, there have been a couple of tumor lysis syndrome patients, but not as serious as the ones that got us all scared to begin with. So I think you need to be careful. There are grading systems for patients potentially subject to tumor lysis syndrome based on kidney function, electrolytes, tumor burden, et cetera, and disease subtype. And if they're a low-risk patient, then you just treat them as an outpatient with that drug. And this is built into their protocols now. And consume your fluids. And if you're higher risk, there's another way to manage them. And if you're real higher risk, then they should start their treatment in the hospital. It is overall as well tolerated as anything else, but there's an education process that'll have to take place as to how to test for, monitor for, and manage tumor lysis syndrome. Of course, as soon as it gets out there, the first patient that dies of TLS is just going to create havoc with it.
In terms of the theme of newly approved agents in lymphoma, I wanted to get your take on adalimumab, which is approved in CLL, but also in follicular lymphoma. And I was curious about your use of this agent in FL.
It is a drug which I now use very commonly. We didn't have anything that worked in BR failures. And that's what I use up front in my follicular lymphoma patients. And I didn't use any R-CHOP because I didn't think it would work in someone who failed BR. There are no data that says that it does. So we would just, you know, have clinical trials, fortunately, but after that, you know, maybe they go on lenalidomide or something or other. But now we have a drug which has a very impressive track record in these patients, and I'm using it frequently in relapse follicular lymphoma where we don't have a clinical trial available. And I've seen very nice results, and most patients, the vast majority, tolerate it well, don't know that they're on it. And the disease responds quickly and nicely.
Any other common tolerability side effect issues with adalimumab?
That's been the big one, has been the diarrhea. There's rash you can get. There's some pneumonitis.
What about liver function abnormalities?
That was the next one coming out of my mouth. I've got one right now. There's a lady with cutaneous marginal zone lymphoma, and nothing worked. She was spot radiated for a while, and they were chasing it around like whack-a-mole. And then we tried her on rituximab, we tried her on an alkalinity agent, she got this, nothing worked. And these lesions are growing and growing and growing, becoming uncomfortable. I put her on IDELA. Within days, they were gone. And we saw her in clinic, and we checked her CBC, as you always should, and her metabolic panel, as you always should, and her transaminases were in the thousands. So we had to stop the drug. It's seen in around a quarter of patients with lymphoma, less so with CLL for reasons that are unclear. And you just got to stop the drug. It's almost never clinically significant. You can frequently retreat the patients once the transaminases return to a respectable level without concern. I've got a CLL also who's run into the same problem, not to the thousands, but 700-800s. It's something we see, but we haven't seen any clinical sequelae from it. But it's something you've got to watch. Again, these are pills. Yes, most patients tolerate them fine. Okay. but they really work and they have effects on not only the bad cells, but some of the good cells.
Let's talk a bit about mantle cell lymphoma. And again, with this theme of new and novel agents, we now have ibrutinib, bortezomib, and lenalidomide all approved in mantle cell and relapse refractory disease. How do you incorporate these agents into your practice?
I give ibrutinib first because it's got a higher response rate. And then I give lenalidomide. I've had some durable responses to lenalidomide. I've had a patient out for about 3 years in remission after failing a stem cell transplant. And, you know, whether BR comes first or afterwards, or, you know, we're going to have a clinical trial, a really cool clinical trial very soon that will include mantle cell, which include a second generation BTK inhibitor in combination with a checkpoint inhibitor. And we're excited about that. And
this is anti-PD-1?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that when we get to Hodgkin. But going back to these choices, we're hearing a lot in myeloma about the oral proteasome inhibitors. And there's exazimib, which seems to be similar to bortezomib, looks pretty effective. First of all, are these agents, the oral agents, being looked at in mantle cell? And if, you know, you could get that kind of efficacy, would you think more about it if it were oral, or are you just not impressed with it?
I'd have to see what the response rate was. We did some studies a while ago with that drug. If it was better tolerated and more effective, you know, if it now got response rates of 40% or so rather than 25%, then I'd be more interested. But again, we have so many new, exciting opportunities in the way of some of the drugs we've mentioned that a lot of patients want to go on clinical trials.
Any comments about the use of bortezomib up front? We've seen some data
in
that, you know, with the R-CHOP replacing with bortezomib, the vincristine. Any thoughts about those data and any situations where you might consider using bortezomib up front?
Well, those data presented by Franco Cavalli were very interesting and got the drug approved in that situation. But the comparator was R-CHOP, which, if you look at the NCCN database, is really the sick puppy of all the treatments for mantle cell unless you chase it with a stem cell transplant. On top is, you know, you get BR and R-hyper-CVAD and R-hyper-CVAD transplant, and whatever. Even R-squared up there looks better. So again, the comparator is the problem in a lot of these clinical trials. The companies pick the sickest one they can use to kick around because they want to get their drug on the market. You can understand that, and we appreciate it because it gets good therapies on the market. But once it's available, then you've got to look at, you know, how did it win this? What was the population, and what was the comparator, and what else is out there?
One final question about mantle cell. How do you approach the younger patient with mantle cell specifically?
Well, I'll probably get shot for this, but I use BR in that patient population also because based on the STIL data and the BRIGHT study, BR was better than R-CHOP across the board, but particularly in mantle cell lymphoma. In the STIL study, it was at least as good in the BRIGHT study. But wherever it looked to be better, it was in mantle cell lymphoma. It's certainly better tolerated than R-hyper-CVAD. And in fact, if you look at the long-term follow-up of the R-hyper-CVAD data published by Romaguerra a couple of years ago, those curves just keep going down and down and down and down and down. So I use that up front. We have clinical trials, which we have patients accrued to, and I don't transplant them. Yes, again, I'll be criticized for saying that, but transplant doesn't cure these people. It may prolong time to progression, but there aren't good data that it prolongs overall survival. We participated in an ill-fated study looking to see how good BR was compared to R-hyper-CVAD. It was a national intergroup study where patients were randomized to BR or R-hyper-CVAD followed by stem cell transplant. And it was shut down very early because they couldn't harvest stem cells after the R-hyper-CVAD, which surprised pretty much everybody, but that was the story. So I give them BR. The question is, what do you do if they don't get a complete remission? And we've had a lot of discussions here. The transplanter, some say, oh, I wouldn't transplant them because they have sort of refractory disease then. Others say, oh, yeah, they have to have an allo transplant. Goes round and round. What I have started to do off-label here, folks, is R-squared regimen in these people, rituximab and lenalidomide. And some of this is based on the data from Cornell, that Ruan et al. From John Leonard's group published, where the R-squared combination frontline had over an 84% response rate, with the vast majority of those, I think like 70%, were complete remissions, and an 80-something percent progression-free survival at a few years. Very interesting data. It's an active regimen in follicular, and so I've just started trying it out in the patients who get a PR because I'm concerned leaving these people without anything, but not to the point where I feel that a transplant may help them.
So you mentioned R-squared, which I know has been something you've been very involved with and interested in. Where are we today with R-squared, particularly in FL?
Yeah, R-squared is a regimen we came up with over a decade ago. We did a study first in relapsed follicular lymphoma, where we compared R-squared to lenalidomide alone. We had a third arm of R alone. We couldn't get anybody to put patients on study with an R alone arm, so we dropped it. Study was completed and should be published relatively soon. We saw a much higher response rate, CR rate, and progression-free survival with the R-squared compared to lenalidomide. Those sorts of data led to us to look at the regimen up front. And Nathan Fowler from MD Anderson, my former fellow, left Georgetown, went to MD Anderson, also did it there. And what both of our groups showed, that the response rate in follicular is in excess of 90% with maybe 75-80% complete remissions, very durable PFS and overall survival, and well tolerated. These data led to the relevant study, which had more than 1,000 patients. It was an international pharmaceutical sponsored trial, now complete, of R squared versus R chemo, which could be R CHOP, R Benda, or R CVP. And we are very interested in seeing the results of that study because it could really change how we approach the initial therapy of follicular lymphoma.
So I want to make sure we talk about Hodgkin lymphoma. Why don't we begin with your 36-year-old lady?
Yeah, this is a 36-year-old woman with a longstanding history of asthma, and she developed a painless cough and neck swelling. She was treated with a Z-Pak, which was unsuccessful, and she then underwent biopsy of the lymph node, which showed nodular sclerosing Hodgkin's lymphoma. She had a PET CT scan, which showed non-bulky disease limited to her chest, so she had limited stage disease, no symptoms. So we started her off on ABVD. After two cycles, we did a PET scan, and it was negative. And thus, we planned on only giving her four cycles of treatment. Had it been positive, we probably would have done 4 to 6 cycles, probably 4 cycles followed by radiation. However, the follow-up scan, 6 to 8 weeks later, showed some new nodes. And we tried biopsying one, and all we got was inconclusive. And so we repeated a scan in a couple of months, and that node got smaller but brighter, and a new node popped up in the right supraclavicular area, which we biopsied, and was persistent NS Hodgkin's lymphoma.
How long ago was this that this happened?
9 weeks, 10 weeks ago.
Wow, interesting. Okay.
So we planned on giving her a stem cell transplant, and the question was how to get her to the stem cell transplant. Typically, we'd use ICE, which, as you know, is challenging, requires hospitalization. She has young kids, makes you really sick, lose your hair, and all that stuff. And there are some interesting data now from several groups looking at brentuximab as the preamble to the stem cell transplant and running response rates of 50 to 70% perhaps. But there was a recent abstract presented at the ASH meetings in 2014 from Anne LaCase at the FABA, combining brentuximab with bendamustine and getting a response rate well in excess of 80%, most of which were complete remissions, and it was a well-tolerated regimen. And I think if she came to me now, I would probably use that to reinduce her. We gave her 3 cycles of BV, brentuximab vedotin, and we were going to repeat the scan and see where we stood. If she was now PET negative, then she's going right for her transplant. If she were PET positive, we'd probably institute bendamustine at that time because it has a high response rate, but they're not very durable, but they're good for bridging to transplant.
So I'm curious what your thoughts were on the issue of post-transplant BV in patients, obviously, who haven't had it pre-transplant. We saw some data from the so-called Athera trial at ASH. What did that look at? What did you think about it, and did it change your practice?
It didn't change my practice because we didn't have much of an opportunity to use BV after transplant, but it certainly will now influence my practice because the data were rather compelling that BV post-transplant was really effective compared with observation. How that will still look with more and more people using BV either prior to transplant or as part of initial treatment. There's a large study, the Echelon trial, of ABVD versus A squared VD, the A squared being Adria adcetris for brentuximab. And that's an important study because the preliminary data, the pilot phase 1 and phase 2 data, look exceptionally promising. And the phase 3 hopefully will confirm those.
So I've been asking this poll question at our solid tumor meetings and finding that investigators don't know the answer, at least the solid tumor investigators. The question is, to this point, which of the following looks like the most responsive to anti-PD-1 checkpoint antibodies? You know, we put in melanoma and the usual characters. In the bottom of the list, we put Hodgkin.
It's Hodgkin's.
Nobody puts that, but I say, hey, that's the answer. And you want to talk a little bit about that? Certainly, to me, one of the most fascinating things I've seen in the last few years, the two papers presented at ASH, or the two data sets.
Right. Just when we thought you couldn't get better than brituximab, along comes nivolumab.
Right. And pembrolizumab.
And pembro. And in relapsed refractory Hodgkin's, the response rate was over 80% with a number of complete remissions and with virtually no side effects. It was just minimal grade 1-2 stuff. In the other study with pembro, it wasn't quite as high, but the patient populations were a bit different and it was small numbers of patients, so those obvious variabilities can influence response rate. The question is what to do with those drugs. And do you want to save them for the end? I would think not. We are now developing a trial for upfront Hodgkin's. Older patients who don't do well with ABVD and don't tolerate it well either, combining BV and nivolumab.
Yeah, I mean, we saw some data on the issue of, you know, just BV upfront in older patients. And I guess that looked like, I mean, it hasn't really been studied that much yet, but maybe not as exciting as we hoped. But the idea of combining those two sounds like really a wild idea.
Yep, that's what we're planning. I have a little consortium I've put together with Steve Ansell and others, and the protocol is being written. The response to BV was okay, but in one study, it was always chased by ABVD, so you don't know what it really did.
Right.
And the other, the relapses occurred. This is a curable disease. You don't want to lose that opportunity. But when you take two 80% drugs and you put them together up front instead of post-transplant, hopefully, A, they will be much more effective, and B, they'll be well-tolerate.
Any comments on sort of the biology of Hodgkin lymphoma and why it seems to be so responsive? We saw data on, I think it was a chromosome abnormality that seems to be tied into PD-1. Obviously, we know the way it looks under the microscope, but kind of going beyond that.
Well, there is a chromosome abnormality that, as well as EBV infection, which upregulates PD-1. And EBV has been implicated in Hodgkin's lymphoma. So you have upregulation of the PD-1, the PD-1 and PD-L1 axis. You know, I call it like the Ambien for the T cells. It puts the effector cells to sleep. And you need a drug to wake them up. And there are, I can't even tell you how many PD-1 and PD-L1s that are out there now. It must be close to 10 being studied in clinical trials. And I don't know which one will be the best. I don't know how different they are from each other, but they certainly are stimulating an extraordinary amount of interest